Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 Radio from beautiful Urbana, Illinois on this lovely summer Sunday, July 16th, 2006. Our guest today is a guest we've had several times on the show in the past, but it's been a while, so I'm delighted to have him back. He's one of the leading investigative journalists in the United States in the English-speaking world, and he's the author of a brand new book, Armed Madhouse, which has just come out and is just storming up the bestseller list. So it's a real pleasure to have this best-selling author take time from his schedule to join us. Greg Pallast, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, Bob. Glad to be with you.
Hey, well, let's start with Armed Madhouse, your new book. And people who want to learn about this can go to your website, gregpallast.com, where there's all sorts of good information about it, plus clips from many of your recent articles you've written. What's with the title, Armed Madhouse?
Well, it's you remember Ginsberg's poem, Howl, it's the soul should never die ungodly in an armed madhouse, and kind of my thinking and the image you have on the cover from Winston Smith is, the armed and dangerous inmates have taken over the asylum. In fact, the full subtitle kind of gives it's Armed Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf, China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child Behind Left, and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War, because the real point of the whole crazy title here is that that whether it's stealing elections, which kind of reporting I'm known for, trying to assassinate Hugo Chavez, the educational policy of pogroms against teachers, these are all just various parts of attack of those who have against those who they don't want to have. It's class war.
Well, let's talk, if we can, before we go into the book any further. You've been writing in the last week or so about the Mexican election, and I think you've been sort of at the cutting edge here in the United States at covering it.
That's a very funny way of putting it.
Yeah, okay.
The cutting edge, what you mean is that I'm actually reporting the news, and the New York Times is reporting the press releases from the ruling party.
Well, yeah.
How do you want to put it that way?
That's one way it could be put. And, in fact, I was going to ask you about the way the New York Times and the other U.S. media have been covering the Mexican presidential election. And then talk about what you see is going on from your research.
Well, I call the New York Times. I was down in Mexico City, and I saw what I call the New York Times socks and bathrobe reporting. They stay in the Sheraton Hotel. They go down to the bar, then they go up to the ballroom for the press conferences. You know, one party then the other. They talk to all the guys who went to Harvard and a couple professors, and they repeat the official line. So that the official line was. And this is a quote from the New York Times. And by the way, I like to pick on the Times because they are the self-described paper of record, and they are the best that there is out there within the American media. I make an exception for the Wall Street Journal, which actually has reporters. But basically, the New York Times is the gold standard of the usual dreck. And what they do is that the Times wrote that the election in Mexico was fair. And, that this is the new democratic trend of Mexico. They finally have fair. Now, how do they know this? They look out the window of the Sheraton, and they don't see any cars burning, so it's fair. Now, they wouldn't go to Guerrero State, where, the rest of the country had a 70% turnout, but yet the challenger state, a guy named López Obrador, his main state where he gets a vote is Guerrero. The Guerrero supposed turnout was only 44%. There seems to be a whole lot of missing ballots, as well as voter suppression. Why don't they go to Guerrero to find out what happened to the vote? And the answer is because it's like stepping outside the Mexico's green zone. They'll get killed. And so it's so fair that they're actually afraid to go where the voters are because they could get shot. But that's true of the voters who try to express their opinions as well. So the New York Times guys, they actually, like I said, they can just stay in their socks and bathrobes for the reporting that they do. And the rest of the media then gets their reports from this crew. Secondarily, Reuters, AP, the more bathrobes and socks guys. There are no reports from anywhere. Look at the bylines. I always tell people all the time, when you read American newspapers, look at what they call the dateline, which is actually the location. Here it's Mexico City. At least that's an improvement. Sometimes you'll get the Latin American elections, and the dateline will actually say Washington, D.C. So at at least this is an improvement. They're kind of inside the country. Mm-hmm. They're in the Sheraton, which is kind of really a kind of commercial American embassy, but that's about it.
And, well, what is going on down there in Mexico for the sake of our listeners who have okay. only been exposed to New York Times coverage or no coverage at all?
New York Timesy coverage.
Yeah.
The answer is that it's a typical Mexican election, which means it's not an election at all. It means more like Florida. In fact, it has more in common with Florida than one can imagine, and that's one thing I've been reporting. That is, you've got a challenger, López Obrador is his name, and he supposedly lost by less than a quarter million votes out of 40 million, whisker thin. They don't have electoral colleges count of the votes. I mean, that's, less than a quarter of a million votes, less than 0.5%. However, there are nearly 1,904,000 ballots which are not counted, which are sitting in the Electoral Commission of Mexico City, and the challenger, the New York Times, says he is a fiery populist demagogue attempting to overturn the election. He's asking that, surprise, the ballots be opened and read, these 904,000 ballots and all the others. They are shipped in from these from areas of Mexico where there's basically zero voter observation, zero ballot control, virtual plantations, people literally being shot trying to get to the polls, which has not been reported in the Times. And so he's saying that at least those ballots which made it alive to Mexico City ought to all be counted in front of TV cameras and in front of the observers, okay? That's a pretty simple demand. By the way, the number of uncounted ballots is four times the supposed victory margin. Now, the ruling party, the ruling clique, the PAN, they do not want to count the ballots. Okay, now that's the new democracy of Mexico, which is, frankly, a repeat of the American democracy. The reason I mentioned that...
Now, what's their argument for not wanting to count those 900,000 ballots?
Oh, I talked to the ruling party's kind of foreign minister designate, a guy named Saro Khan. And in his British accent, I think his connection to Mexico is, I think, going to a Taco Loco in Oxford at some point. This guy told me that it would be illegal to count the votes. And I don't doubt that in some way, but in fact, the Mexican Constitution says that the elections, there's a general rule within the Constitution. Unlike the U.S. Constitution, which has no right to vote, in the Mexican Constitution, you have a right to vote, and it says elections should be fair and transparent. So there is grounds to have the votes counted. And the other is this kind of general, the idea of democracy, which is democracy involves counting the votes outside of our continent. And I say that with dripping with undisguised sarcasm, because that's exactly what happened in Florida and Ohio. It's very important to, the reason I went to Mexico is not so much to cover the Mexican election, but to see the reflection of U.S. methods. Mexico elections used to be stolen the old-fashioned way, literally like this kind of intimidation of voters, burning ballot boxes, throwing them in the garbage. And they had some of that. There were literally a lot of the challengers' votes were literally found in the garbage dumps of two different states. Yet, interestingly, the numbers of those ballots showed up in the tallies favoring the government.
Hmm.
Now, that's the old-style Mexican stealing, burning the ballots, shooting the voters, that type of marking their ballots for them, et cetera. The new method is fluoridation. What I mean by that is in Florida in 2000, is 179,788 votes were never counted. Almost 180,000 votes were cast, ballots cast, not counted. When people looked at those images of the hanging chads and that type of stuff, the American newspapers didn't explain that what this was about was taking ballots which were supposedly unreadable and what they called spoiled. And I know my research would be crazy about me using this joke again, but you don't spoil votes by leaving them out of the fridge. These are ballots which are supposedly have no choice for president. But what that means is that someone, for example, on a punch card tried to punch through, and a little tiny punch hole, a little bit of it, still made the little hole thing, which they call a chad, hang there. Now, obviously, if someone punched Al Gore's name and just hung by one little piece. They were trying to vote for Al Gore. Now, machines cannot read those things, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But humans with eyeballs can, real easy. And what Catherine Harris did was stop the count, the same exact of the 179,000 ballots. She said, you have 48 hours. Well, it takes about a week to do those. To get those. And by the way, while we were looking at hanging chads and butterfly ballots, see, butterfly ballots, you know, this is a media show, and I want to, and so this is a good opportunity to talk about how these things are covered. You heard a lot about butterfly ballots because it was a rare instance in which rich people's ballots were screwed up. It's usually poor people's ballots, which you don't see. So all the cameras were down in Palm Beach taking pictures of women in string bikinis at Palm Beach and talking about butterfly ballots. Yet the real stealing was in places that got zero coverage, like Gadsden County, which is the blackest county in Florida, where one out of eight ballots was simply disqualified, supposedly unreadable. Obviously, it's an all-black county. It's a Gore County. And the ballots that were disqualified, most of them have, and you'll like this one, Bob, most of them had people had written in because the word had written in Al Gore. It said write in candidate's name mm-hmm. on the ballot. It was a mm-hmm. mistake, and it was weirdly printed. Write in candidates, a lot of people wrote in Al Gore. Those ballots, according to Catherine Harris, were unreadable, and the intent of the voter was impossible to discern. You like that?
Yeah, that's great.
That was because it was black people's intent, right? I'm sure if it said George Bush, we might have had a different outcome, but not really. It said Al Gore. Those ballots did not count for Al Gore, all right? So we had the same thing, which Catherine Harris stopped the count of the vote in 2000. Now we move to Ohio 2004. Nearly a quarter million votes were, again, ballots cast and not counted. And in that case, John Kerry didn't even ask that they be counted. At least Gore said, gee, maybe we ought to count some of the – he didn't remember, he didn't even say a full state count. Let's count at least some of the ballots, okay? In the case of Ohio, Kerry didn't even ask for recount. There were 600 lawyers standing around waiting to actually go through the ballot count,
mm-hmm.
and he stood them down. I can tell you that Mr. Edwards is not happy about that, his running mate. And that's a little inside for us. Now, 2006, Mexico, the same thing. They just simply watched how they did it in Florida and Ohio. You have a bunch of spoiled ballots. They say, "No, we're not opening them." You don't have to shoot anyone. You don't have to. You know, they did shoot a couple people, but basically, it's using Bush family methods. Now, where'd they get the ideas? How come Bush family? The other thing that was not reported properly in the U.S. some of it was that the Bush administration went so far as to steal the voter lists of Mexico. They even used the very company that, if you remember, for those who don't know, Greg Palast. I think for those who know Greg Palast, a lot of them and a lot of people in America know me as the reporter who broke the story about how tens of thousands of black voters were scrubbed off the voter rolls in 2000. And, you know, they're as felons. Their only crime, I discovered, was that they were voting while black, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was also fixed the election in Florida. Even before the non-count, you had tens of thousands of black folk who couldn't vote. So that would have also been the margin. Well, the company that came with that scrub list is called Choice Point, and under a war on terror contract, which was marked top secret, this company, Choice Point, was assigned to shoplift to go steal the voter rolls of Mexico and Venezuela, which they did. They got caught, by the way.
How long ago was this?
Now, this was done a couple of years ago. Now, one of the things I wanted to do when I went down to Mexico was to see whether the Choice Point lists were used. I think that the Choice Point lists were used in Venezuela. The company itself wouldn't know because they hand over this stuff to the government under the war on terror. It looks like they were used in Venezuela. In Mexico, those lists, I think, were too old, and I discovered that the ruling party did, in fact, have illegal access to voter files and citizen files, but it looked like that they were slightly different than the Choice Point ones. So the main point was what lengths the Bush administration was going to go to monkey with and export the Florida-style shenanigans south of the border to interfere in others' elections.
And the Bush administration, in your view, has a clear preference for the current claimed winner of the election?
I wouldn't call it a clear preference. I would call it that they're going steady with the ruling clique.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about the oil, another thing not much discussed. The ruling party wants to allow what they call participation by U.S. oil companies in developing Mexican oil, which, by the way, they provide out. Mexico exports more oil to the U.S. than Saudi Arabia does. I mean, this is our second biggest, after Canada, our second biggest source of oil, import oil. Whereas the Challengers Party said, well, we'll take some investment money from the U.S., but no, you can't own a piece of the Mexican oil system. This is the heart and soul of the Mexican Constitution. The Mexican Revolution was the nationalization of the U.S. oil companies half a century ago, and they won't allow it to be undone. That's what it's about. So it's about the oil.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Greg Palast, the author of the new book, Armed Madhouse. You can learn more about Greg Palast at gregpalast.com. He is a very well-known investigative journalist. We've been talking about the recent Mexican election and the coverage Palast has been doing of the process there, which has parallels to Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004. And what's going to happen down in Mexico now? What's your sense of where things are at politically, Greg?
Quite different than the U.S., which is that Obrador, López Obrador, it was like a fantasy come true. I mean, I don't really care, by the way. I don't take partisan sides in the U.S. There's a quote in my book, "We Hate That SOB," as a blurb from the White House spokesman. People think that's the Bush guys. No, that was Clinton's people. I'm not partisan. But my big fantasy for democracy was that after the 2000 race and after the 2004 race, is that Kerry and Gore would have stood up in front of the White House with the evidence of the fraud and said, count all the votes. And here was López Obrador in front of the Mexican White House in Mexico City, in front of a 8-story projection screen, projecting the evidence of fraud with 500,000 screaming supporters chanting vota por vota, which means vote by vote. And the demand for democracy. Now, here's something interesting. When the similar thing happened in the Ukraine and the U.S. government wanted to remove the Ukrainian government, the New York Times and the other papers talked about, the Orange Revolution and how wonderful it was that people were standing up for democracy and not permitting this, because there was obviously a stolen vote count. And the Republican Party was saying, hey, the exit polls don't match the official results. And this was Senator Richard Lugar. The exit polls don't match the official results, like Ohio, right, 3 weeks earlier. Therefore, that's blatant evidence of fraud, right? Mm-hmm. And the U.S. papers reported the great Orange Revolution. People wouldn't stand up for this, stood up against this fake vote count. In Mexico, it's because the Bush administration is in favor of the fake vote count. We're getting about the demagoguery and the threat to democracy of people demanding the count of the vote. So, again, it's how it's presented here. But in Mexico, it's not presented that way. I have to say that in Mexico, people are looking at it as a real serious uprising for democracy. There's a very good chance those votes are going to get counted or the election will be annulled and rerun.
Are there exit polls in Mexico? Were there exit polls done on the election day?
Yes. Well, they were two things. There were polls just like the day before the election, which showed Obrador taking it, no question, among likely voters. And we had exit polls, which we know were showing Obrador ahead, but the papers, the big papers, refused to run them. Not just the papers, the network Televisa, which is very, very close to the ruling party, suddenly shut down the report of the exit polls because they were showing something obviously different than the than what the ruling party had to offer, than that the ruling party was winning. And even though, so the official numbers were ruling party winning, but the exit polls didn't show it, so they literally stopped reporting them.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Greg Palast, author of the new book, Armed Madhouse. You can learn about the book and about Greg Palast at gregpalast.com. This is a live show of Media Matters on WILL AM 580, so you can call in and talk with Greg Palast. The number here, 333-9455, or the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've been talking about the Mexican election and its parallels to the 2004 and 2000 election in the United States. So far with Greg Palast, Greg Palast has actually been covering this and writing about it. And you write about the 2000 and 2004 elections in Armed Madhouse. Mm-hmm. You also talk about 2008 in Armed Madhouse in the 2008 election. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, it's what I discovered was that there are 1.9 million votes that were cast, ballots cast, not counted in 2000. 3 million
nationwide.
Nationwide, yeah. 3,600,380 exactly ballots cast, not counted in the 2004 election. Again, I don't see reports that this is one of these things that's hidden in plain sight. And I expect it to go to 5 million in 2000. The trend is not just the trend; it's the change in laws which will lead to 5 million ballots cast and not counted, or voters rejected at the polls, especially with the new ID requirements. And by the way, if you're wondering where I get those numbers, okay, I'm a statistician by training, an economist. Those numbers are available from the Election Assistance Agency of the U.S. government. And the reason I mention that is that after I wrote in 2004, you'll see at the beginning of Armed Madhouse, a chapter called Kerry Won, Now Get Over It. I wrote Kerry Won for the Guardian papers in just after the November election and reported on BBC television, where I report for their big nightly news show called Newsnight. And the New York Times called me up and said, well, we want to investigate the 2004 election. We see that you wrote that Kerry won. I said, well, this is great. And so the New York Times, and I have this in writing, by the way, the New York Times asked me to give them the information on the theft of the election of 2004. And their first question was, are you a sore loser? And the New York Times' second question was, are you a conspiracy nut? And the third question, there was no third question. That was it. And the next day, I kid you not, they ran a front page story saying, internet theories of Bush spread by blogs easily debunked. That was the New York Times investigation.
I remember that story very well.
Yeah, front page. And that wasn't mentioned because obviously it's hard to say that a Guardian and BBC television report is, you know, internet blogging. So they took some high school teacher who actually did some interesting analysis of the improbability of the results, and they just savaged this woman. Not mentioning that her stuff was then repeated and backed up by the University of California statisticians there. But, you know, again, like, why this type of treatment, and why aren't you getting this news? And what I want to say about the 3.6 million votes not counted and it being there in public records, yes, it's not in a press release, I admit, but it is, it's there. And in other words, I want to inform the New York Times of the rule number one of investigative reporting by that journalist Yogi Berra, who said, it's amazing what you'll see when you look. And that's what's missing here. In other words, it wasn't a press release handed in by the Republican Party. You know, internet theories of Bush loss are bogus. And that's what they reported. So what can I tell you? I did, by the way, offer. I didn't just get the fact. I actually offered the Times the evidence, just as I previously offered evidence to U.S. networks. And my reports on BBC, which, by the way, you can also see at www.gregpalast.com. BBC, in fact, has just created a special new Greg Palast page because of the intense interest in Americans and getting on the net and sucking down the BBC reports, which they're denied here. Now, you have to understand that BBC has a deal with ABC television, and all our reports, and my reports, can be rebroadcast for free, but there's just no way that they're going to accept it.
Seems like the news media is scared to death of touching any of these election stories in the United States or with friendly regimes to the United States.
I think they are scared to death. They don't want to look. I mean, it's, you know, we can all speculate as to why. In fact, you're much more of an expert. I defer to you, Bob, as to why this happens. But to a great extent, I think reporters, when I look at these guys in the bathrobes and socks running up and down the elevators in the Sheraton getting their news, you could see that, one, on the deadlines they have, on the budgets they have, and if they were to come up with a story about the theft of the election, what would be required of them would be a astonishing, and it's just not going to be allowed. It's just not going to be allowed, and certainly not on the big, on the TV networks. I mean, and, you know, it's just outside the realm of what is considered possible reporting. I mean, it is attacked as conspiracy nut stuff, and even my reports of scrubbing, one thing I point out in our madhouse, my story of the scrubbing of felons, which, and they scrubbed again in fake felons of just black people in 2000, they redid it in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And the only report I could find on television of the scrub was on Fox News, where they had some guy said, you know, the Republicans have been accused of scrubbing black people off the voter rolls, and they can't produce one single person. You know, just a blank statement on Fox, just, you know, they have an expert. Well, okay, just in case you hear that report, it's not true. and then so I say, you know,
preemptive strike, so to speak.
Yeah, and so I have like 70 illustrations in the book, and one of them is Mr. Fund, who's this guy who was on Fox. Meet Mr. Steen. He's, you know, a young black voter. You know, I have his picture of a guy who was scrubbed. You know, I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, so and my story of the 2004 election did make it to ABC television finally. But on their website, in which they had a notice, a little report saying, BBC is about to issue a report that the Republican Party is scrubbing, and you'll like this because we reported this, black soldiers from voter rolls, which is what we discovered, okay?
Mm-hmm.
ABC just want people to know that it's not true. and the source was a woman named Mindy Tucker Fletcher. And Mindy Tucker Fletcher, for your information, is the official spokesman of the Republican Party. So there it is, the official spokesman. So I don't want you to think that ABC was just making up the news. They knew that BBC was wrong because the official spokeswoman for the Republican Party said, this report's coming out and we want to warn you that it's wrong.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Greg Palast, author of the new book, the bestseller, Shooting Up the Amazon Charts, I noticed, Armed Madhouse.
To the annoyance of the New York Times, Armed Madhouse is on the Times bestseller list.
Amazing. Congratulations on that.
Well, it's amazing for another reason, Bob.
Okay.
I'm going to bitch now because the media show. Because unlike Coultervision, where Ann Coulter was all over like SARS on your TV sets, I have not been allowed on one American television program, not one. It is my second Times bestseller.
Yeah, well, that's quite an extraordinary statement. It's worthy of a show for us to do at some time. It comes up many times with authors we get on the show who've written books like yours.
It's amazing. I mean, how many times do you have a double New York Times bestseller who's not been allowed one appearance? I mean, my publisher is like, this has never happened in our history. It just doesn't happen. And I say, get used to it.
Well, callers who want to have a chance to talk to this New York Times bestselling author, call us here at Media Matters at 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now.
Mm-hmm.
Line 4, Farina, thank you very much for your patience. You're on the earth, Greg Palast.
Hi. It's an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
And, thank you, Bob McChesney.
Sure.
I've got two main things I'd like to ask you to update everyone on, the Enron story and the Halliburton story, but I have a theory about the California so-called energy crisis of the 2003,
yes,
late 2003. One of the brownouts was in the Santa Clara Valley. It was one of the only brownouts, and so that some of the chip manufacturers and others had to shut down for a day or two or three, and that seemed to almost be the beginning of the fall of the of the computer makers in that area, and then in California, and then the domino effect of the downturn in the economy after Bush was confirmed. Anyway, if you could comment on generally on
This is Greg Palast, and let me comment at least on the Enron piece, which, and again, here's the media story there. In 1998, I won the equivalent of Britain's Pulitzer Prize for exposing a company named Enron for its nefarious activities, whereas in the U.S., you had reporters still licking Ken Lay's loafers. In fact, at that time, after that exposure, Thomas Friedman called him in the New York Times, our liberal paper, that said Ken Lay was the Elvis of American commerce. And there goes Elvis. At any rate, what happened, the update for the Enron story. which I followed very much. There, in fact, there's a chapter, and you got to, by the way, I want to apologize to everyone reading Our Madhouse for the really terrible British puns throughout. So there is a chapter called When Arnold Got Laid, about Arnold Schwarzenegger's secret meetings with Ken Lay in the Peninsula Hotel in Beverly Hills. Secret, which we know about because an insider obviously slipped out some minutes and memos of that meeting. And what it was a... basically, Ken Lay feared one thing greater than going to jail, and that was giving back the money. And Enron and its power pirate compatriots had nicked the state of California consumers for at least $9 billion. And they had a governor, normally a dull guy named Gray Davis, who actually stood up on his hind legs and said, give us back the money. And he filed lawsuits, and he went to the federal government, and he was really taking action. He even called them power pirates. So Ken Lay's reaction was, you know, who will rid us of this, you know, troublesome vicar? What we need is someone. We need someone else, someone in the state of California, who will agree to a deal which would basically allow us off the hook. And sure enough, after that, and he invited in Schwarzenegger and other guys who were kind of potentials for Davis's replacement, and lo and behold, right after that, a recall campaign was begun. Davis was replaced by the Terminator, who within weeks literally signed off on the exact deal that Ken Lay proposed in the hotel room, so that Lay and his buddies paid it, you know, nickels on the dollar for the money that they stole from California. And furthermore, what was very interesting about that is that while Ken Lay was convicted, justice was not done, in the sense that it was like Al Capone being convicted of not filing his taxes. It was very similar to that type of case, because Lay was convicted of paper shuffling crimes involving the SEC and bank loan documents. But in fact, the big crime of conspiring to fix the California power market and literally flicking the light switches, turning the power on and off deliberately to raise prices in California, he was not touched, because to touch him would have involved busting and putting in leg irons about a half dozen giant investment banks, about including the secretary, our current Secretary of Treasury. It would have involved busting a dozen power company chieftains.
When did Schwarzenegger make this deal with Ken Lay and Enron?
Well, he attended the meeting. I don't know if they ever shook hands on it, but all I know is that he attended the meeting, the deal was proposed, and then Schwarzenegger, when he came in, carried it out. So I don't know if they – I always be very cautious. I wasn't in the meeting, so I don't know if they shook hands on it.
But it actually was shortly after he was elected.
The meeting took place before Schwarzenegger even ran.
No, I understand that, but the deal...
The deals were done, were done within a couple weeks of being elected.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Greg Palast, the author of the brand-new bestseller, Armed Madhouse. You can learn more about the book and about Greg Palast's writings as an investigative reporter at www.gregpalast.com. We have several callers waiting patiently. If you want to call in, the number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Spring Bay now. Spring Bay, you're on the air with Greg Palast.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I was reading last week Richard Heinberg's response to your talk on peak oil. Mm-hmm. And just wondering if you have any comments on that. The New York Times came out with an editorial by Robert J. Semple a while back, online, talking about peak oil, and then, of course, the interesting thing was that the next day they ran a big ad from ExxonMobil saying, don't worry, be happy, everything's fine. Where are you coming from now on peak oil?
Okay. Yeah, and, Greg, before you answer that, if you could give some background, because I suspect a significant percentage
right.
of our listeners...
Right, I don't want to get too distracted with a complex discussion of peak oil, except to say that the watch, my website, I'm going to put something on Guerrilla News Network about this. This came out in our madhouse. Let's give it a look. More important is the context. In our madhouse, I did it for BBC. It writes up my investigation of the war in Iraq and the war in Venezuela for BBC. And one of the things that I discovered is we actually went out and spent 2 years, seeing if there were secret plans for the oil fields of Iraq within the Bush administration. And indeed, there were. There were two plans. We got a hold of them both. But the plan that, that controlled was one written by the oil companies out of Houston, and even though it had the stamp of the State Department on it. And by the way, one of the things we did is that we did secret tape recording to get this stuff, another thing not done by U.S. reporters. And I have to, because these guys lie through their teeth. In fact, the oil company, just so you know, Bob, the oil company executive threatened to sue Harper's Magazine, which ran my reports that are out of our madhouse, and said, we never even spoke with Greg Palast. This was a big oil company executive.
Mm-hmm.
And so Harper said, well, we'll retract Palast's story if you tell us which part of this audio tape isn't you.
Mm-hmm.
they just lie, these guys. So one of the things we found out is that we didn't go into Iraq, to my surprise, to get the oil. We went in to suppress the oil, to not get the oil. And once, as an economist, it suddenly the light bulb went on. Well, of course. I mean, the lower the supply, the higher the price. I mean, Bill Clinton left when oil was $20 a barrel. It's now $75 to $80 a barrel. That's mission accomplished. That's what these guys want to do. They didn't want to go in to get the oil. And see, and part of the, so the peak oil theory is that Shell Oil in 1956 issued a paper saying that that it looks like we got a whole lot of oil, but that's not really true because we're going to soon run out and the oil will crash and we'll run out. And that was Shell Oil's prediction half a century ago, written by their chief geologist, a guy named Hubbard. So what I was saying is that this peak oil question, and some of his stuff was actually quite sophisticated. I'm actually an energy economist by training. His stuff had some great value and sophistication, but the use of it has been, a lot of people think we went into Iraq because we're running out of oil and the oil companies are panicked, and so they have to go get this new supply of oil. That's not true. They went in to make sure that Iraq would not produce more than its OPEC quota. We've been suppressing oil in Iraq for since its founding, for 7 decades. It was created as a place to suppress the production of extra oil out of the Mideast when Winston Churchill invented it. That was its purpose. And so it's interesting, went into this history of the oil company suppressing oil production in Iraq and the fanatic desire to make sure that they don't, that this berserker with a mustache, Saddam, doesn't suddenly bust the rules that said he could not produce more than 2 million barrels a day under oil for food, and then bust the OPEC quota of 3 million barrels a day. This berserker could go up to $6 million a day, and put Saudi Arabia, the House of Saud, and the House of Bush out of business. Mm-hmm. Real quick. So their concern was not getting the oil, but making sure we don't get the oil. That was the most interesting thing. And so what I did was I had a kind of a sidelight about, you know, questioning the idea that we're about to run out based on this peak oil theory of Shell Oil from their geologist Hubbard. There is a more sophisticated side to this in which I discussed was looking at why the Bush administration wants to kill Hugo Chavez. In fact, there's a chapter in our madhouse called "The Assassination of Hugo Chavez." And again, I was down in Venezuela speaking to the president, checking out the president of Venezuela, checking all this out. And I do want to warn you that today's New York Times does tell you that Hugo Chavez is a dictator. He's an elected dictator, it says, versus Bush. And I'm quoting you from the article comparing Chavez to Bush that's out today. Bush has been a model of executive self-restraint. Okay, so Bush has been a model of self-restraint with Guantanamo and midnight arrests and wars versus Hugo Chavez, who is obviously a dictator. Why are they going after Chavez? The answer is because he's sitting on more oil than Saudi Arabia. That's one thing. You'll actually see the chart in the book from inside the U.S. Department of Energy, which they did not want us to publish, which we got our hands on, showing that Venezuela has big oil. And there is a constant fear of a flooding of the oil market and bringing down the price of oil. Exxon is not afraid of running out of oil. Do you think that corporations are afraid to tell you that they have less of a product? I mean, every resource company dreams of a shortage of their product. I mean, it's silly to say that oil companies are hiding the fact that they have, that they're running out of oil. Though they're the first to run out there. Chevron's running 2-page ads saying, we're using 2 barrels of oil for every barrel of oil we discover. Now, of course, they don't want you to think that we're, it's very subtle, they don't want you to think we're absolutely going to run out any minute, because then you might want to, like, you know, come up with an alternative, you know. But on the other hand, so they want to just say there's very little of it, but we're not quite running out, but there's very little of it. So it's a very, this is the oil company line. Unfortunately, there's some people in the environmental movement who are buying the this old shale oil theory of the peak, and hope that rising oil prices will save our planet from horrid pollution. There's many reasons not to use oil, but the idea that we're somehow hitting a peak and we're just about to crash and run out is not true. We shouldn't burn oil because we don't want our kids sucking soot, man. But we have to stick with the facts.
Yeah, our guest today on Media Matters is Greg Palast, author of the bestseller Armed Madhouse. We have callers waiting to talk to Greg Palast. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Farina, Illinois, that hotbed of Media Matters listeners, with yet another caller. Welcome to Media Matters. You're talking to Greg Palast.
Oh, thanks a lot. Oh, it's such a great honor to talk to you, Greg Palast.
Thank you.
And we so appreciate how you're keeping on the election scandal. I'll keep it simple. I wanted to ask you if you think Ken Lay's really dead, or if he's, like, hiding. And also if you had anything on the wiretapping issue. And have you heard Neil Young's new song, Let's Impeach the President for Lying? And do you think there's any hope in the air that, you know, like a new revival can be coming up?
Well,
that's quite a bit. Well, thank you for the compliment. And as to Ken Lay's, well, if Thomas Friedman is right that he's the Elvis of commerce, then we'll be getting sightings of Mr. Lay pretty soon. Let's put it this way. I haven't gotten any calls from him, so I can't. So at the moment, as I used to say about Franco, he's still dead. On the other hand, one thing I want to say that's even more important is that the gang, they may have gotten one gangster here, but the gang lives on. That's very important, and the scam lives on. Now, as to, let's see, what the other question was?
A wiretapping scandal?
Wiretapping scandal. The first chapter of our Madhouse is Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? And it's about the fake war on terror, which has turned Ground Zero into a profit center for the cronies of Bush and Cheney. And the wiretapping, okay, let's remember that on September 11th, we were all attacked. We were the victims. By September 12th, somehow we all became suspects. Why are they creating these lists? Well, I can tell you, for example, when they look at the financial records, believe it or not, Osama bin Laden no longer uses his ATM card. The big contract in the war on terror, Choice Point, which created over $16 billion records on Americans, has said, you know, if we had our systems in place when the hijackers showed up on September 11th, we'd have caught them. That's because they used their own names, right?
So, mm-hmm.
And as you know, of course, my understanding from Al Qaeda is that they no longer use their own names when they check in. Osama bin Laden doesn't check in as Osama, even though he loses his frequent flyer miles that way. I mean, but that was one of the weird artifacts of the period, which is that these guys actually took their frequent flyer miles. So it's a fake. Okay, they're not going after the terrorists. But then the question is, what are they doing? Okay, and first of all, there's this false dichotomy between our safety and our liberties. You know, like, well, we have to give up a little liberty to have a little safety. They're not going after the bad guys. Like, when I looked at that Choice Point contract for the war on terror where they stole the voter rolls of Mexico and Venezuela, there was nothing about going after, for example, the files of Saudi Arabians. And 15 of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, nor from the Emirates of Pakistan, where the rest of the hijackers came from. It was a targeting Venezuela and Mexico. There's always a second. There's always a real reason. It's not about abusing our liberties, but in return we get safety. We're not getting safety. What we're getting is stolen elections, an attempt to steal elections in Mexico, an attempt to steal elections in Venezuela, which they failed at doing. And in the case of building these files on us, this is about making sure that the voters don't make a mistake in the next election. It's again about building the list for the election. It's not about building the list to save you from the bad guys.
Have you heard the Neil Young song the caller asked about?
Just very briefly. I don't have it in my. I haven't done my iPod downloader rip yet.
Well, what's your take on impeachment?
Well, I guess that's an interesting idea. If we have enough songs, does he get impeached? I hope we can sing our way out of this. I certainly like the music.
But what do you think? What do you make of the impeachment case argument? Do you think?
Well, you know, I brought to America's attention something called, which later became known as the Downing Street Memo. And when I brought that over from England, I didn't uncover it, but I first brought to U.S. attention. It was an article called "Impeachment Time," when you deliberately and knowingly lie to the public about matters of life and death and war, you know, that's impeachment time. I mean, it's the Watergate story all over again. It was literally a misuse of the intelligence, deliberate misuse of the intelligence agencies, and that's why Nixon was facing impeachment. I realize not as bad as a stain on a blue dress or whatever, but it's still an impeachable offense. That being said, you know, I don't see it happening as a practical matter, but is justice always done? Not swiftly enough.
Now, what about the Democratic Party? What's your take on the U.S. Democratic Party at this point in time?
Well, my view is let sleeping dogs lie and let lying dogs sleep. I mean, one of the things I just did, if you go to the gregpalace.com, is to say that what we're missing is a López Obrador. We're back to where we started with Mexico. What we're missing is someone standing up and making counting the votes an issue. Now, there is a split in the Democratic Party. I have to say Howard Dean, the chairman of the party, has been a big fan of mine. Not that I'm partisan. I would like to see the Republicans get behind the idea of counting the votes, too. But unfortunately, it's not a unanimous concept within the Democratic Party. And that's because all politics is local, and you got a lot of local guys. And the example I use is Zell Miller. Zell Miller was one of the people that stopped the National Democratic Party from doing something about the massive theft of vote, of black vote in Georgia. He says, if you stand up and see, because we're talking about the loss of votes in America, as I point out in our manhouse, you got 88% of the votes which are not counted are cast by minority voters. So the Democrats don't want to be seen as the colored party. You know, this is what killed Michael Dukakis, that hug from my friend Jesse Jackson. When Jesse Jackson hugged Michael Dukakis, George Bush Sr. won the election. That was it.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phone lines, Greg, because we have one caller who's been waiting very patiently. Okay. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Greg Palace.
Thank you. And I'm one of those people who helped get you on the bestseller list not once but twice.
I really
enjoy your books. And
I another for your mom.
really liked the graphics in it as well. Pretty good. But I especially liked your tracking of the battle and the musical chairs going on within the Bush administration's Iraq policy between the neocons and the big oil. And I'm wondering if you think that battle is essentially over and big oil has definitely won, or if the neocons are going to be able to, you know, launch another counterattack?
Both. And by the way, I'm glad you said that, because I was very worried. The second chapter is called Trillion Dollar Babies, and it's a really complex story of this huge internal fight between big oil and neocons within the administration. And because too many of us on the progressive end kind of think of it as a monolithic organization, but within it there's huge battles. Because there's so much money on the table, so much at stake. And I thought it might be too complicated, but I'm glad you enjoyed the kind of back and forth of it. The answer is never bet against big oil and Saudi Arabia. These guys have a combined throw weight of 500 million barrels of oil. They win. They'll always win in the end. However, the neocons have a way of always coming back from the dead because they have uses. They're the public voice of the, you know, they're the kind of shock troops. They're kind of the SS of the Republican Party. And so they have their value. And so I never discount the neocons, but I never bet against big oil. So I think the battle will always go on, never ending. But right now, just so we'll clue in those who haven't read Armed Madhouse yet, which is that big oil was the one that was pushing to suppress oil production in Iraq and create a state oil company that would maintain its OPEC quota. They called it, you know, this was a secret plan. So, and the neocons actually wanted to bust OPEC by ramping up production in Iraq. And, of course, Big Oil just said, listen, son, that ain't how it works. We don't ramp up production and start. Right now, Exxon is earning $10 billion clear every 3 months. No one's seen profits like that since the Pharaohs. And they don't want that game to end. The lack of production out of Iraq, the pipelines on fire, those guys love it. And they're not going to let neocons come in with some crazy berserker scheme to bring down the House of Saud. That ain't going to happen.
Greg Pelz, what, we only have about a minute or so left, but what role does is the sort of ability of corporations like Halliburton or Bechtel to sort of take part in the reconstruction of Iraq, or what's called the reconstruction of Iraq, and the billion-dollar contracts they're getting, how significant is that in the whole understanding of what's taking place in Iraq?
Well, obviously, it's a huge profit center, but it's really nothing compared to the guys who are really making out who planned the occupation. One of the things that we do have in the book is that you have these big K Street lobbyists who literally, the lobbyists, drafted the plans for the occupation of Iraq, including the lead guy was Grover Norquist, Jack Abramoff's partner. And so it wasn't just one corporate. So we see the guys. Halliburton's problem is that they're kind of public because they've got a public contract. But what you should be looking at is things like the sales of Iraq's banks to a consortium of U.S. and Chinese bankers. And that's much more, you know, that's the hidden stuff. The entire plan was basically to suck up every asset of this nation, including controlling its oil. So you have to look at this entire kind of corporate army that preceded the 82nd Airborne. And that's very, very important to understand the game. And Halliburton's kind of like the embarrassed public edge. It's normally you don't actually get to see it. What Halliburton is interesting because it's kind of a peek under the ruling elite's skirts for a moment, and you get to see Halliburton. But what you don't see is Chartered Standard Bank had their fingers in it. Microsoft had their fingers in it. Sony Records had their fingers in it. I mean, the list is kind of really strange and eerie and creepy to think that the war was to some extent directed not from the Pentagon but from K Street. The Pentagon guys are not happy with the way it was done.
Greg Pelz, author of Armed Madhouse, the bestseller, thank you so much for being our guest today here on Media Matters.
Bob, always a pleasure, really.
Yeah, well, good luck with the book, and I'll be back in 167 hours. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters right here in WILL AM 580. I want to thank John Anderson sitting in as my producer this week while Andrew O'Boyle is doing research for us over in Ireland, and Brett Polson, our engineer. See you all in 167 hours.